Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. According to what I've just been told, here's the podcast for the Early Morning Late Show. Enjoy our conversations.
Morning, 6:04 Central Time on the fourth day of April, the 94th day of the year 2018. I'm Neil Statham, sitting in for Bill Arnold, off for another day. And we're thankful that you've tuned in to Faith Radio today. Hope that your morning will start out well. I'm trying to remember where I was the morning that I heard the news that Martin Luther King Jr. was shot. He was killed on this date, 1968. On the balcony outside a second-story room at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis. And just reflecting on that, Rebecca, that, you know, I don't remember. I remember where I was when I heard that President Kennedy was assassinated in the grade school, and the principal came in, and, we all reflected. But that was in 1963, but 1968, I think I was probably heard the news, but not, well, it maybe didn't impact me particularly.
Didn't hit as close to home.
Yeah, my rural county community. I don't know if there was, I wasn't aware of a person of color. And it took for probably many years before I started becoming a little more aware that, there's, and as Revelation 7:9 talks about, there'll be some from every tribe and tongue and nation.
Amen.
And, yeah, so
I think that's often the way, though, with historical figures, the movers and shakers. Sometimes you only see their legacy as much as they have an impact. Sometimes when they're alive, seeing it in the rear view. And yeah. Sadly, but I guess for the future benefit of many of us, Martin Luther King's death became a catalyst for the movement that he lived to promote.
Well, it's been 50 years, and coming up later today on the Early Morning Late Show, we'll reflect on a gathering and hear from a couple of good friends of Faith Radio that are at this gathering, considering where we are today in terms of understanding God's heart for justice and the importance of unity in the body and understanding race and faith. We'll get to that with Carl and Karen Ellis. That's the second hour. Bill English will also be along later this morning. And we're going to hear, of course, Kent Kaiser comes in regularly. And in just a moment or two, Matthew Sorens will join us. Matthew's been a regular guest here on the morning show as well. And we're going to talk a little bit about immigration because, as you know, the president's been tweeting, and generally, when he's tweeting, he's not happy, and it seems like there's a lot of that going on. So we'll have a good visit with Matthew Sorens coming up in just a moment as we think about Martin Luther King and the impact of his life and legacy today and the 50th anniversary of his assassination. And I thought we'd just share just a portion of one of his well-known speeches, one of his final speeches.
So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
It's so good to have you along on a Wednesday morning, 9 past the hour, on the Early Morning Late Show. I'm Neil Statham, sitting in for Bill Arnold, and joining us right now, the phone, Matthew Sorens. Matthew serves as U.S. Director of Church Mobilization for World Relief, and among other things, he's written an award-winning book, Seeking Refuge on the Shores of the Global Refugee Crisis. It was winner of the Christianity Today's 2017 Book Award. And he's been an award-winning guest in the past. Glad to have you back, Matthew. Good morning.
Glad to be back.
So we want to talk immigration because the president has been, I don't know if he's been talking about it, he's certainly been tweeting about it, and he's essentially saying no more when it comes to DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. Let's jump in there. What, does the president have you know, reason to be upset.
Yeah, I think, you know, I've been watching those tweets like everyone else and trying to make sense of them. You know, the president said a number of things about the DACA program, Deferred Action for Child Arrivals. At one point, he said he wanted an act of love. He, you know, wanted to deal compassionately with the beneficiaries of that program. We call them kids sometimes, but they arrived as kids. Many of them are now in their 20s or you know, young adults. And then very recently, he said there's no DACA deal. You know, basically, he doesn't want to negotiate on that anymore, which I think is really disappointing, to say the least, for the hundreds of thousands of people whose lives are really, you know, kind of hanging in the balance with the DACA program. What happens if the DACA program goes away fully? And right now it's kind of held up in the courts, so it's not been fully done away with, as we thought might have happened by now. But if it goes away, it means all those young people lose their work authorization, which means they lose their jobs, which means they could even be at risk of deportation. And in some cases, the countries that they don't remember, because the average DACA recipient came as a 6-year-old to the United States, some of them even younger than that. So I think it will, you know, we don't know yet what will happen, and the president could obviously change his mind again. And I think that's what we're praying for the president, praying for members of Congress who ultimately have the responsibility here to move forward on legislation. But it is, it's a lot of uncertainty for the people who are directly affected by this. And many of those people are, I mean, I have colleagues at World Relief who we can employ because of this. I've got people at my local church who are, in fact, my daughter's Sunday school teacher is directly affected by this. So it's an issue for the church as well.
And you mentioned about, you know, it's Congress's responsibility, and it certainly seems that Congress has not acted in a wise or meaningful way over the years on this, that it has just gotten more convoluted as they've tried to, you know, deal with in some sort of reasonable immigration reform. What's your sense of, you know, and I guess that's part of the angst right now, is because the president has, you know, said we're waiting for the Democrats to take some action on this, and then they haven't been doing anything, apparently.
Well, I think that's a little bit, there's lots of politics here, obviously. So what happened in the Senate, at least, about more than a month ago now, was there was a series of proposals that went forward. The closest that got to passing, you know, got around 55 votes. It was a bipartisan proposal that would have basically paired a border wall, $25 billion over 10 years for a border wall, with an earned path to citizenship for those people we call dreamers, people who benefit from DACA and others in their situation. And that proposal the president actually issued a veto threat for, because it didn't also cut legal immigration. And the proposal that did those things plus cut legal immigration by about 40% only got 39 votes in the Senate. So it's really pretty far from passing. And that kind of created a stalemate. So the White House's position has been they want a cut to legal immigration of about 40% by cutting most family reunification options. And that's kind of been the sticking point at this point. So most people seem to agree on we want more border security and we want a solution for dreamers. But the Congress has not been willing to go into cutting legal immigration significantly.
You've been working in the area of immigration for many years. What's your sense of the feeling, the workers that, you know, World Relief and others that are welcoming those that are coming in? I mean, is there a sense of maybe despair, or is there hopefulness?
You know, I don't think we can give in to despair. It's definitely bad. It's been a tough season, and you know, not so much for us at World Relief, for our staff, as, you know, much more so for the families that we're interacting with. You know, again, these young people with DACA, or, you know, we have other issues that have happened in the refugee program where the numbers have been cut really dramatically, from about 100,000 in 2016 down to about 30,000 in 2017. And now we're looking at somewhere around 20,000 for this year, the current pace of refugee arrivals nationally. So that's hard, because we interact with the family members of those people who thought they were coming and who are not. And again, many of those are people within local churches as well. But, you know, I think we always hold on to hope, and it's both a part of the history and legacy of this country, as well as, more importantly for us as Christians, as believers, it's the central part of our faith that, you know, we're called to welcome the people who God puts in front of us, and we can advocate for changes to policy, but we also just need to be faithful to loving the neighbors who are, you know, able to become our neighbors in a proximate sense, living, you know, in our communities.
We'll come back in just a moment, and we'll talk more about, you know, the church's response by loving our neighbors. Also get an update on the Syrian crisis. In fact, Matthew Sorens has written about that recently in the award-winning book called Seeking Refuge on the Shores of the Global Refugee Crisis. Matthew's U.S. Director of Church Mobilization for World Relief and is with us today on the Early Morning Late Show. It's 16 past the hour. The hour, and the Early Morning Late Show is underway with Matthew Sorens as my guest, U.S. Director of Church Mobilization for World Relief, and he was a previously served as field director for the Evangelical Immigration Table. It's a coalition of evangelical organizations of which World Relief is a founding member. He's co-authored the book Welcoming the Stranger, Justice, Compassion, and Truth in the Immigration Debate, and Seeking Refuge on the Shores of the Global Refugee Crisis, where he focused particularly on what's going on in Europe as a result of a war in Syria and ISIS. And just give us a little update, Matthew, if you will, and maybe what's happening in Syria and the unsettling conditions across the Middle East.
Yeah, unfortunately, the civil war in Syria continues, and there's been some progress against ISIS, but that's just one of the actors in a multifaceted war in Syria. So the government led by Assad is certainly still in power and still definitely using a lot of violence towards some of its own people, and that's been the primary cause of people having to flee. So if you look at the numbers, they're really, really rather horrific. About 12 million people have had to flee Syria in the last 6 to 7 years. They've had to flee their homes in the last 6 to 7 years. Most of those inside of the country, so they'd be considered internally displaced. But 5 million of them have actually gone outside of the country and become refugees, which is when someone has fled a well-founded fear of persecution and then gone to another country. So most of those folks are in Turkey or Jordan or Lebanon. In fact, in Lebanon at this point, about 1 in 4 individuals is a Syrian refugee. So you get a sense of just a scale of how much that refugee crisis is impacting really the whole surrounding region. And it's definitely a really tragic situation. But again, even there, we do see the church in some of those neighboring countries responding in really heroic ways, both to the immediate human needs and then helping address some of the longer term issues that come out of a situation of mass displacement like that. So that's something we get really passionate about at World Relief, is how do we help empower the church right at the site of where those conflicts are happening, as well as, you know, the relatively small number who might be given the opportunity to resettle and begin a new life in the United States.
You know, say more about, you know, the church's response. I mean, you used the word heroic. You know, if we look across the landscape, whether it's, you know, obviously Lebanon, 1 in 4, what a strain that is to certainly the local economy of the country, but certainly the believers there are doing heroic work. But what would a maybe heroic response look like in this country as well, as we relate to those that are refugees or immigrants in reaching out?
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, some of the places where we partner with local churches in the Middle East, you know, there are churches. I think that's maybe a story that doesn't always get told, but they tend to be really small. You know, they're not mega churches with thousands of people in for the most part. They're small little congregations that are in some ways are marginalized themselves. And that's even in the most generous of countries in the Middle East. But, you know, I'm thinking of one church to it. They're serving roughly 1,000 children on a regular basis with a variety of programs. And I mean, this is a small little church. It's probably a few families that make it up. And I just think if we you know, if our brothers and sisters in Christ in places where the resources are frankly just a lot less are able to respond that way. And they would probably say, well, we didn't have a choice. If people just showed up and, you know, we're followers of Jesus, what could we do but extend God's love to them? But we have opportunities in the United States both to come alongside them in prayer and financially, but also there are families that arrive in the United States and not nearly in the same numbers. I mean, at this point, there's actually really very few refugees arriving, as I said, but there's some, and there's refugees who've been in the community for a number of years. There's other immigrants as well who have, you know, other stories of why they left their countries, but some of the same cultural adjustment needs. And we're just really passionate about Relief Fit, seeing the church be a central part of their integration process into the country, of helping them learn the language, understand the culture around them, and most importantly, just having a friend, having someone who will welcome them, who will show them kindness, who will show them God's love. And again, many of these people are brothers and sisters in Christ. Others are not yet Christians. And with that comes the opportunity to be a witness of who Jesus is, in some cases for people who would probably have never encountered him in their country of origin. And so we see God working even in the midst of a really horrific human crisis, but God in his sovereignty is working even through those situations to draw people to himself.
Matthew, you mentioned right at the outset, we were talking about DACA. You said even your daughter's Sunday school teacher is affected by this. So how do you talk to your kids about the biblical perspective on welcoming the stranger and justice and compassion and truth in this sort of immigration debate?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, my kids are probably uniquely aware of these issues just because of the household they grow up in, but also because of the community we live in, where a lot of our neighbors are directly affected by this. One thing I've tried to do with our kids is, even as we read through the Bible, to point out to people, you know, as we read the story of Jesus, you know, the Christmas story, that what we think of as a Christmas story with Jesus fleeing to Egypt, or, you know, in the Old Testament when Abraham is called by God out of his land and into another land, to help them see some of the parallels there to these stories in the Bible. People were migrating, they were moving, and sometimes God calls people to move. Sometimes people have to move because there's a dangerous situation. There's someone wants to hurt them, like King Herod wanted to hurt Jesus. And that still happens in our world today, unfortunately. And, you know, then I just really encourage them to think through, you know, how would you want to be treated if we had to go to a new country and we didn't speak the language? That's how we can treat, you know, the people who show up in your preschool classroom who are in that situation, or who are neighbors down the street who might be new in the country and you have a hard time communicating with because they don't speak English yet, which for kids, it turns out, is not a very big deal. They're really great at adapting and playing with kids, whether or not they speak the same language. But, you know, I think it is really important to teach our kids about these issues, to help them develop a sense of empathy and understanding. Obviously, at age-appropriate levels, you don't want to expose them to all the horrific realities of why people have fled, but on a basic level, they can understand these things.
Empathy and understanding goes a long way for no matter what age we are. Right? That should be a foundational principle, I guess, as followers of Christ.
Yeah, I think that's definitely right. It goes back to that golden rule of doing to others as we want them to do unto us. And, you know, I've not just for kids, but for adults, I'll often ask people, just kind of imagine yourself if you were sort of dropped into at an airport halfway around the world and didn't speak the language. Wouldn't you be grateful if someone from a local church was there to meet you and to work with you through an awkward language barrier and help you understand what was going on around you and find a job and get on your feet? And that's the opportunity that we have with refugee families, but other immigrant families in some cases as well.
Matthew Soren serves as U.S. Director of Church Mobilization for World Relief. It's worldrelief.org, right? Isn't that the web address?
That's right. That's right.
worldrelief.org. Check out great work of the World Relief team in a variety of areas. And Matthew's written about welcoming the stranger, justice, compassion, and truth in the immigration debate. That's one of his first books. He also wrote Seeking Refuge on the Shores of the Global Refugee Crisis. And join us today here on the Early Morning Late Show. Matthew, always good to talk with you. Blessings to you.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
26 past the hour, and you're listening to the Early Morning Late Show. There's more to come.
It's morning. The good part, that's up to you. With a little help from Bill Arnold and the Early Morning Late Show on Faith Radio.
I don't think we should correlate the childish mind games with Kent Kaiser coming up. No, there's no connection. whatsoever. Glad to have you listening this morning. Hey, speaking of connection, hope that you will connect with us next week, especially during our spring share. It's when we talk about the remaining needs, this listener-supported ministry, and we're just honored that so many of you stand with us financially and support us monthly, many ongoing monthly givers, and that's such an encouragement to us. So I want to just say thanks for those that do your part regularly. It means so much to us, and it's an opportunity for you. If you're new to Faith Radio, maybe just to discovered us in one of our new FM signals, or maybe you're in Bismarck 89.1, our latest outlet. We'd love to hear from you. Next week, it's Spring Share here on Faith Radio. And, of course, you can make a gift anytime online at myfaithradio.com, myfaithradio.com. Did mention Dr. Kent Kaiser, Communications Chair at the University of Northwestern. He'll be in the chair in about 10 minutes, so that you'll stick around for that. We'll take a news break right now. It's 25 for the hour. The Early Morning Late Show is underway. I'm Neil Stavem, sitting in for Bill Arnold. We've got Dr. Kent Kaiser coming up in a moment. Today, the 4th of April, is the anniversary, 50th anniversary of the death of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. And if you can't be at the National Civil Rights Museum today for MLK 50 events, you can watch them online. The live stream from the former Lorraine Motel gets underway 10:30 this morning. Memphis officials say they expect 75,000 visitors to this city for MLK 50 events. Next hour, we'll hear from Carl and Karen Ellis, who are at an event in Memphis sponsored by the Gospel Coalition, and we'll get an update on that. But I thought we'd take just a moment to hear what became the final message from Dr. King before his assassination. And it had, it was a reminder that none of us know what tomorrow may bring, but he had his vision in place and communicated powerfully. Let's take a minute just to listen.
Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And He's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
Dr. Martin Luther King, his final address. We're reflecting on that today. Gospel Reflections from the Mountaintop coming up next hour on the Early Morning Late Show. Coming up in just a minute, Dr. Kent Kaiser, we're going to talk about some other issues there's some mountains to climb. We've got some difficult days ahead as we reflect on the news and the challenges before us. We'll get to all that in just a moment.
Examples of anti-Christian bias in our educational system number in the thousands. An overstatement? No way. This is Jim Garlow. Take, for example, in Texas, high school cheerleaders were sued for displaying Bible verses on their banners and posters. A high school football coach put on administrative leave for praying on the field with his players, voluntarily. Students in New York prohibited from even forming a Christian club. Clearly, one of the biggest spiritual wars in our culture is the battle in our schools for the very hearts and minds of our children. This blindness to the eternal value of faith can only be for one purpose, to knowingly or unknowingly try to turn an impressionable child away from a faith that saves and points to an ultimate accountability and that our nation ignores to its own detriment. There's more at jimgarlow.com.
21 before the hour. The Early Morning Late Show on a Wednesday morning is underway. I'm Neil Stavem, sitting in for Bill Arnold. And that's the walk-up music for Dr. Kent Kaiser, communications chair at the University of Northwestern in St. Paul, where we broadcast from the campus. And we're honored to have Kent as a regular guest. Good to see you again. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me on.
We're reflecting a little bit about the life and legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King, and we're just talking during the break. I mean, that he was a preacher. He was reverend.
Yeah, it's important, I think, that we remember that and help other people to remember that. I can remember a time, it was about a dozen years ago, maybe a little more, when I was in grad school, and one of the professors showed the I Have a Dream speech. And all the students in the class thought it was a great speech, but none of them were Christians, and none of them understood the meaning of many of the allusions in there. I had to actually explain, like, the dream sequence and all these other different things to them because they were biblically illiterate, which to me is culturally illiterate. But it was just one of those profound moments when I thought, wow, these people, of course, loved Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., but didn't understand, like, really where he was coming from, and why that particular speech. And that particular speech was powerful in so many ways, where it was delivered in Washington, D.C., which is basically a southern city, but on the border, and really what he was trying to do is appeal to northern white Christians with that speech. And of course, the other students who were listening to this didn't really understand that until I explained, the context and the meaning and stuff. That's happened to me a couple times. There was another time, like about 30 years ago when I was an undergrad, I can remember being in a literature class and we were reading Moby Dick, and the professor, after we had read the book, and by the way, this is a class where it was really intensive. That book was a 2-day book, okay? So this wasn't like, we were spending a lot of time on this, but the professor asked, how many people here are unfamiliar with the story of Jonah from the Bible? And more than half the class raised their hands. And I was a freshman, coming from a church background, and my mouth, my jaw must have just hit the floor. I couldn't believe that people wouldn't even know a basic story like Jonah. But I think it's important for us as Christians then to understand that that is the biblical or cultural illiteracy of our culture. And so when we have the opportunity, like now, recognizing the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., that we need to make sure that everybody kind of understands that, yes, he was a preacher, and much of what he was talking about was drawn from the Bible.
Which is certainly what we're passionate about here at Faith Radio, too, is like bringing a biblical worldview to bear on the culture around us.
That's right.
Yeah. Hey, speaking of culture and what's going on in the news, I want to talk about one of the items that has gotten a lot of, I guess it's gone viral. That is the Sinclair news stations that have suggested that their anchors talk about making sure their coverage is fair, and they've actually had a little kind of canned statement to read, and a lot of them did it just like they wrote it up.
Well, yeah, it's interesting. Sinclair has many stations all across the country, and they sent out this canned message, so a prepared statement for the anchors to deliver, and it was asking people to be vigilant about fake news, and if they saw anything that was awry with one of their stations, they encouraged people to write in. I think it was a very good thing to do. I think that, it's actually a good citizenship type of thing for Sinclair to do this, to promulgate this message that if you see fake news, let us know. If you see anything we do wrong, let us know. The funny thing, though, is that when you have a canned statement that goes out and all kinds of different anchors read it, then, of course, somebody can put together a montage by just grabbing all of these screenshots or these little video clips from all across the country and put them together, and then it looks kind of funny. Now, to the individual viewer, they're only seeing their one station, yeah. But when you put these all together, which is what someone did, then you see all these different styles of delivering this canned message, and it is literally the same words because that's what it's supposed to be. It's a prepared statement. And so people had a field day laughing about this. And this isn't the first time this has happened. It's happened from other news organizations. It's also happened where, as a public relations guy, I've seen this where some company or some entity puts out a statement, and the news organizations often are so lazy that they literally read what we put in the press release, which we love. As PR people, we love that. That's perfect. That's when we know we've done our job well, when you send something out and the news people read it verbatim. I always said that was when I was, you know, at my best as a PR person, when they just read it as is, or when they take it and put it in the newspaper as I wrote it, you know. And of course, that's known as lazy reporting. But that's what sort of happened in this case. Where it takes a kind of a partisan turn is where some people are criticizing it as being pro-Trump. Well, there's nothing pro-Trump about it. And unless you say that just the acknowledgement that fake news exists is pro-Trump, or if you're saying to people, hey, tell us when you see fake news, somehow they see that as pro-Trump, I don't think so. But that's what some people on the liberal side are suggesting that this message was. Now, they of course, ignore the fact that there have been liberal news organizations who have done basically the same thing, sent out canned statements, and there are montages of those also out there on YouTube for people to see.
Which I guess we should probably go do some looking just to get.
Well, it is kind of funny to see that. It is funny to see the side by sides, because it is funny to see the different styles, because you can see that some anchors are delivering this with lots of vim and vigor, and others are, you know, delivering it with ennui, and others are somewhere in between, you know, and some are really firm, and some have a lot of emotion, and some just don't, and so it is funny to see them side by side.
It is does I guess, you know, make you wonder a little bit about who has editorial control, and, you know, how do we safeguard against fake news?
Well, there's that. I mean, although this isn't really a news story, no. This was an announcement of, you know, like I say, about good citizenship, about alerting them to instances of fake news or where they maybe weren't doing their job. So I don't see a problem with a canned message in this case.
It almost seems like probably, you know, we broadcast in the public interest, and if you believe our coverage has been unfair, let us know. It's 46 past the hour. Dr. Kent Kaiser is in studio. We're going to talk more with him about this and other stories of the day coming up in just a moment on the Early Morning Late Show. Eight past the hour. The Early Morning Late Show is underway. Dr. Kent Kaiser is in studio, communications chair at the University of Minnesota, University of Northwestern. You got the Minnesota shirt on, though. That was confused me. The
trying
sweater.
To stay warm here.
Oh, yes. Well, yes. Here it is, April 4, and it's still sweater weather.
Yes.
Happy about that. All right. There's a caravan moving through Central America that has gotten some news. The president's been talking about that. 1,000 person strong, surging toward the United States southern border. Let's talk caravan.
Yeah, it's interesting. They are literally walking from Guatemala through Mexico and coming towards our border. About 1,000 people. It's families, little children. I saw videos of them coming through some town where they basically come through the town and they take over like the parks and stuff for a while to rest, and then they keep walking. And of course, this raised the president's ire, and he's been tweeting about it. And it's interesting what he's tweeting against then is DACA, and that's that proposed law about, or, you know, the policy of giving sanctuary to the children of illegal immigrants who have been here for quite some time. And so what's interesting is that this caravan of people is coming up wouldn't even actually be under DACA or affected by DACA because they wouldn't have been here for the requisite time, which is several years. I can't remember how long, but several years that they would have had to be here in order to get sanctuary and be given citizenship here in the United States. But he had to tweet out something, I guess, you know, some kind of a response. And so he said, no more DACA deal. And this has been very interesting to me because, you know, the deal that he proposed at the latest deal that he had proposed was very generous, much more generous to the illegal immigrants and their children than was anything that was ever proposed by Obama or that the Democrats were even asking for. But as soon as Trump proposed this DACA deal, as he's calling it, the Democrats suddenly had no more interest in DACA, which just, it's so disappointing because this is just another example of just how partisan Washington is, where here you give them all of what they want and more, and they just oppose it for the sake of opposing it because it's Trump's idea.
So at 1.8 million, I think young people would be allowed
right.
in. So
right.
it would have been a tremendous step, seems like.
That's right. And so I just, it's very disappointing. And it just shows the partisanship in Washington. And now I suspect we're going to get nothing.
Which is even more sad that
that's right.
politics has affected so many lives in this area. You, I know, worked in the census for a while, and that has become a political issue now, too. What questions can we ask?
Yeah, that's right. Well, it's interesting. The census is coming up. It comes up every 10 years, so in 2020. So we're actually gearing up for the next census already. And I personally worked for the census in 1990 and 2000. In 1990, I was kind of in a managerial position appointed by the first President Bush. And I was in charge of recruiting people to work for the census for a vast area of northern Minnesota. And then in 2000, I actually had another job, of course. At the time, I was working for the Secretary of State. But on the side, I worked for the census. And in that census, I wanted to go door to door. It's funny, I applied, and then they wanted me to be a manager again. It's like, no, I want to go door to door. And I did. And you learn a lot by going door to door. There's two different forms. There's a long form and there's a short form. 80 or 90% of people get this short form, which doesn't have very many questions on it. It asks some very basic questions about your residence and how many people live there and so on. But the long form goes into much more detailed questions, asking you things like how many bathrooms you have in the house and, you know, just, you know, what you do for a living and many, many questions. And one of the questions that was in there up until about 1980 was a question of citizenship. You know, are you a U.S. citizen or not? Or what country are you a citizen of? And then it came out of the census at that time. Because the census, the long form, is really long. I remember when I had to do this, when I was going door to door with the census, on a short form, my goodness, you could be at a person's house for like literally a minute and get all that you wanted. With a long form, you're talking about, you know, probably 10, 15 minutes to get all the information from one household. And by the way, there was one time when I was doing the census over by the St. Paul campus of the University of Minnesota, and there were actually a couple of frat houses involved in this. I had to do 45 boys on a long form. You know, they were having a hot tub party. And kind of, yeah, seriously, one boy came out. He was very helpful. But I was there for like an hour and a half gathering all the information.
Sure.
And so I was very unproductive that day in terms of like the numbers. But yeah,
it took weeks for his skin to start getting pruny after sitting in the hot tub
it's actually a lot of fun. And then I had another one that was a big house of like 20 people who were foreign students, and they really wanted to give all the information.
Sure.
And they were actually surprised that there was no question of where their citizenship was, you know, but they were answering the census. And they were eager to do so because they wanted to be part of this historic process and things. And now, the Trump administration is suggesting to bring back that question. And people on the liberal side typically are saying that they don't want that question asked because they think it'll create a chilling effect for people who aren't citizens and that they'll be reluctant to answer the census at all and therefore may not get counted, which means that if they're not in the population count, then some districts where there are a lot of immigrants perhaps will be undercounted, and therefore those areas won't receive as much representation, particularly in Congress, as they should. And this has always been a point of contention, like exactly who should be counted. And the courts have always said that even non-citizens should be counted. And it's been a point of contention, like other points of contention, like should people who are in prison be counted where they are in prison, or should they be counted in where they came from? And they're counted in their prisons, by the way. And same thing with colleges, actually. There's always this point of contention. Should they be counted where they live in college? Like here at the University of Northwestern, these students who live here on campus are counted as Rosevillians. Because here they are. They're not counted back in their homes because on April 1st of the census year, they will be technically residents of the dorms. Mm. Well, this is maybe a point of contention for Rosevillians who maybe don't think that there should be so much like political power or whatever, or for people who are in neighboring communities who think that Roseville is being overcounted because that's where the citizens happen, or the students happen to reside. So those are some of the points of contention, and you can see then with the number of immigrants that we have in our country, where that becomes a point of contention in a bunch of very specific districts, especially in California and other liberal areas where there are a lot of it's traditionally been counted over the last several censuses and given California a lot of political clout as a result of the numbers. So
time is gone. Census, is there, is it fairly accurate from your perspective?
I think we have, generally, yes. There are a lot of double checks and actually triple checks on the numbers. The one thing I will say is there are places with overcounts, and Minnesota is one of those. And part of it is that we have so many colleges and we also have so many snowbirds.
Okay.
A lot of students get counted twice. They get counted at school and at home because their parents inadvertently put them down on their census form. Same thing with snowbirds. They get counted wherever they live on April 1st, maybe in Florida or something.
Sure.
But then they get counted up here. And here's the thing. If you don't answer the census taker is able to go to your neighbor and ask the questions about you. So if you think you're like not getting counted because you didn't answer the census taker, no. Your neighbors are, let me just tell you, more than happy to tell all the information the census taker wants about you. And I know that from firsthand. You know, if one person, if one neighbor won't tell, the other one will. And so you might, and I know for a fact that people get counted double that way because if they're not home when the census taker shows up because they're in Florida, and then they get counted here because the neighbor gives information, they get counted twice. And so we have an overcount, actually.
We got a roll. Always fun to talk to Dr. Kent Kaiser with us here on the Early Morning Late Show. Stay tuned. Been a great first hour of the Early Morning Late Show. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Neil Stavem, sitting in for Bill Arnold. Great hour just ahead. Bill English will be along with us, as well as Carl and Karen Ellis in the next hour. Stay tuned. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show.